Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Taking a look at wonderful smelling plants on the show today. Mark Dwyer back with us. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Speaker, educator, author. He's degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry. So we're going to look at adding fragrance to your garden and take your calls, of course. What gardening questions or comments do you have? I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Mark Dwyer, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. A pleasure.
Tell you what, I have a morning jog through the neighborhood, and it's so nice right now. The peonies, the lilacs, still have quite a few lilacs in bloom, and it just smells great. And you wonder, then I run by some plants that look great, but they don't have a scent.
Yeah, the fragrance, I think we all appreciate, particularly in spring, and of course, I should say it's a subjective thing. Not everyone, I think, appreciates lilacs like we do, Larry. But, it's that time of year where, with this year being unseasonably cool, things like lilacs, fragrant viburnums, fragrant abelias, a lot of the woody plants that typically bloom early and offer fragrance have extended bloom. And it's just been really a delightful spring with all that emission of wonderful scent.
And someone wonders, why do some plants have scent and some don't?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, I think it's selfish for us as humans to assume that, plants have scent for us, simply for us to enjoy. It's primarily a mechanism to attract pollinators. And, when you think of the scents that are emitted from plants in particular, there are plants that don't smell great, and actually that mechanism of providing that fragrance is also to attract pollinators. But, ultimately, it's related to achieving pollination. And we enjoy a lot of our spring scents, but there's a lot of ways to incorporate, of course, fragrance throughout our own gardens through the whole growing season.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim and Stevens Point has something relating to this. Let's go there. Jim, hi.
Good morning. I have found in the last couple of growing seasons, two annuals, that if you put in a pot and it's kind of right at face level, or a basket that's at face level and you walk by, it's just wonderful. The first is Artemisia, and it smells like grapes, and it's just, or olives, I should say. Olives, it smells wonderful. And then there's another one called Plectranthus, and it's a cerveza in lime, a little mounding plant that if you rub the leaf or get it when it after it rains, it smells like a lime. So there are two wonderful scents as you walk by your pots or baskets.
Sounds good. What do you think, Mark?
Wonderful examples. And that brings up the point, and I think it's important to mention to listeners, is that, fragrance is offered really by two mechanisms. Emission, the fragrance that is wafting through the air, which is affected by wind and humidity and time of day, because we do have many that emit scent at night, which is certainly a topic we should explore. But those that are tactilely induced, those that you kind of rub by, or as your caller mentioned, some rainfall, some sort of inducement of providing fragrance. And consider most of our herbs, the idea of, basil, oregano, rosemary, lavender. We're brushing by those, we're rubbing those, we're incorporating them into culinary use as well. But that fragrance is induced manually and can be just as potent, but there is a little bit more involvement on our part. But in my scented gardens, I like to combine both and really try to engage people to explore the range of fragrances, which is amazing, well beyond emitted scent. That tactile inducement with the Plectranthus and the Artemisia are two great examples, but most of our herbs do the same thing as well.
Jim, thanks so much for calling. Is that something you do as part of your business, Landscape Prescriptions by MD?
I do. If I have a client who has an interest in fragrance, and there hasn't been a client in 20 years, I haven't asked that question, do you like fragrance? And a lot of times it's a no-brainer. They're like, well, of course I do. And I say, well, it's good to know, because we can incorporate some early fragrance with woody plants. We can get some lilies for summer fragrance. There's things that'll offer fragrance through the season, but many of our annuals might be incorporated into a scheme where I'll give clients a list of plants. And just recently, a great example, I have clients that are only out in their garden to enjoy it at night. So what we recommended were night blooming annuals. There's an amazing annual called Night Phlox, and the Latin is Zaleuzianskaya. It's this mouthful starting with a Z, and it's in all our seed catalogs, and it's this teeny little white flower that only opens at night, but boy, does it pack a fragrant punch. And that's a great example, to Jim's point when he called, having it in a container near the deck or balcony or an open window where your proximity to the fragrance is considered. And that's a huge thing to consider in general with a scented garden. How close are you to those plants?
Aren't there some fragrant tobacco plants, if I'm not mistaken? I think I had one year that would the aroma would come up later in the day or evening.
Absolutely, Larry. And what an interesting segue, because about 20 minutes ago, I was planting fragrant tobacco and for that exact purpose. And you're right, the scent primarily arrives at dusk and into the evening, and that's meant to attract evening pollinators, particularly moths. And most of those, they're not native plants for us, but something at the Edgerton Hospital Healing Garden, where I do some work, we're actually incorporating 40 varieties of fragrant flowering tobaccos of different colors, different heights. And our intent is to have a very sensory experience at dusk, because we do have patients and visitors and folks that go out in the garden at dusk. And I love those old-fashioned flowering tobaccos. Those are just amazing.
Yeah, they are indeed. You know, thinking about old-fashioned, it used to be that you could count on roses to add fragrance, but certainly not all varieties have scent these days, and you wonder why sometimes.
Yeah, it seems to be the old-fashioned roses still maintain fragrance, but they've become a little more challenging to grow due to, well, you know, more severe winters, some dieback, diseases and insects are still prevalent with Japanese beetle and all the mildews and black spots. And I don't think they're grown as often, but fragrant roses still exist. And one that I like is a white blooming Rosa rugosa or shrub rose that's called Blanc Double de Corbeil, and it's I'm murdering the French there, but it's a white, semi-double white bloomer that is unbelievably fragrant. It's again Double de Corbeil, I believe is the name, and that brings people back to that old-fashioned wafting sweet fragrance. And it's a tough rose as well, and they do exist, but I do think fragrance is exaggerated with a lot of plants, and that includes roses. You know, I want to smell a rose from 10 feet away, not have to, you know, climb into it to smell it. So, yeah.
Oh, man. Mark Dwyer, our guest today, as we talk with him about your flower garden, and we're zeroing in a bit on fragrance in the garden, but of course we take other questions as well, and you are invited to join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Well, we, you know, lilacs and peonies in spring are great. And you mentioned that we can have scent going on through the year. What about summer? Here we are in summer right now. What are some good suggestions?
Yeah, you know, in summer, Larry, we start to lean on more of our herbaceous or perennial materials and annuals, of course. But when you think of the preponderance of fragrance in spring is primarily from woody early blooming woody plants. We have some bulbs that are fragrant. But as we get into later June and July, we start becoming reliant on things like garden phlox, which also emits a fragrance primarily at dusk and into the evening. Oriental lilies are I'm a huge fan of, and it's important to mention to folks that not all lilies are fragrant, so do focus on the species and hybrids that provide fragrance, and that's usually kind of a July gig. And then, you know, as you get later in the season, the hope is to have warm temperatures to sustain things like the flowering tobacco you mentioned earlier, and there's a whole realm of fragrant annuals like Heliotrope, and which has a scent of vanilla. And something I'm growing right now is Chocolate Cosmos, which is absolutely not hardy, but these dark maroon flowers on this plant smell like dark chocolate, which is truly amazing. And one of the favorite sort of gateway plants for kids is this popcorn cassia, which is it's a legume. It's a tropical plant. Of course, it wouldn't overwinter for us outside, but it gets these beautiful yellow flowers that, if you rub the buds, it smells like buttered popcorn.
Yeah.
So, you know, having kids tell their parents, you know, hey, there's this plant that smells like buttered popcorn. It's important to mention that popcorn plant and the heliotrope I mentioned are poisonous. So, you know, you have to consider, you know, know everything about a plant before you put it in. And that's something to keep in mind.
Yeah. And fall? A little bit more about fall?
Yeah, fall's a little bit more challenging. You know, there is a scent, and I feel like I'm waxing poetic about it, but there's a great woody tree called Katsura tree. And when a Katsura tree starts to get its yellow fall color and the leaves start to drop, it emits this fragrance of literally cotton candy or kind of burnt sugar. And you would never... That's not how they sell Katsura trees. It's not a promotional thing where they say, hey, for those 5 days that the leaves are dropping, you're going to smell, you know, cotton candy. But there's a fragrance that's provided in October. There's not a whole slew of perennials that offer fragrance that late in the season. So, again, your hope is that your annuals continue to offer scent until hard frost kind of shuts the season down.
Elaine in New Glarus had a question for you. She has quackgrass in her perennial garden, and she's dug the garden up twice, but the quackgrass still keeps coming back and wonders what she can do.
It's a huge challenge, and you may have listeners, Larry, that have some advice for this as well. And the issues when I've had quackgrass is there's the understanding that it's never a one-time battle. It's a war that you engage in, because every little root piece will regenerate, and if it went to any degree of seeding, the seed is viable for a certain amount of time. So I had a daylily patch that was covered in quackgrass, and what I did was I removed the daylilies in spring, rinsed off all the roots, so there was literally nothing on the roots, and I had to rely on an herbicide application. Which took care of the quackgrass, I thought, and then within 5 to 6 weeks, it was coming back up again. There are some herbicides that will handle quackgrass, but the real danger is in how it'll affect surrounding plants that you desire. So I'm wary of recommending chemical use beyond, the herbicide I just mentioned, but it's something that manual removal, digging up, hoping you can dig it out, similar to Bishop's weed or snow on the mountain that many of us have at home too, it's near impossible to eradicate with manual control. So again, maybe some folks have some additional advice on how to deal with that.
It would be nice. I know if you're just kind of digging up the garden, all you're doing is giving the quackgrass more opportunities to spread out.
Right, yeah. Right. It's vigorous, without a doubt.
Mark Dwyer, our guest today, and certainly you can join in with your gardening questions. Love to hear from you. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or email us, email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditters, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk as we take a look at your flowers in the garden with our guest Mark Dwyer, speaker, educator, and author. He has degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry as well, so he can answer a broad range of questions. He was also former director of horticulture at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. So join in with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. You know, you mentioned in passing, and it's worth talking about a bit, Mark, healing gardens, greeting healing gardens. Talk about what they're like and how they are used?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, Larry, one of my current gigs is helping manage a small healing garden at Edgerton Hospital, and it's a little 3-acre space. And using that as an example, I think it's important to mention that its original intent when it was constructed was to offer, you know, a soothing space, a respite for not just patients, but for their families, for visitors in general. And it's actually a community garden as well. But it's a little ambiguous when we use the term healing garden or wellness garden. What does that really mean? Because I think it could be argued that all of our gardens offer some of that. You know, they offer us that engagement, a place to relax and enjoy. And actually, some of us find it relaxing to just be working out in our gardens and therapeutic. And interestingly enough, that's one of the things we're really pushing here at this healing garden is engaging physical therapy and occupational therapy patients with tasks and activities outside that have rehabilitative goals, but are also, you know, again, getting outside in a beautiful space with fresh air and flowers and the fragrance we've mentioned. So these types of gardens have a little more specificity with plant material and all accessibility. That's something that's important to mention because the garden in which I work has, you know, 8-foot wide paths to actually accommodate a hospital bed to come out and be wheeled through. So, and I've been to healing and wellness gardens at many healthcare facilities, and they have a lot in common, and beauty is certainly part of that, but they also try to fulfill programmatic goals and also offer amazing views from the rooms. Because the research shows you heal faster, you heal better, you take less medicine, and you're out of the hospital sooner when you have a nice view as opposed to, you know, a parking lot or something. So they're great spaces, but a lot of what I've just mentioned can be incorporated into our own gardens as well.
Bruce in Skokie, Illinois has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, when the caller called in at the beginning of the show and mentioned a putranthus, I just had some additional information about that. Putranthus, if you've ever had mint in your yard, it's kind of invasive. That's a putranthus. And the whole family, with some exceptions, is scented. Not each and every one of them. Swedish ivy is a putranthus, which is the common name. But the one he was referring to was called, I've seen a couple of names. One's Cuban oregano or Mexican oregano, and the leaves are kind of plump, and they're like a lemon lime. And so I've had it for years. There's actually two kinds of Cuban oregano, but it's one of those things, if you saw both of them at the same time, you wouldn't be able to tell them apart. So I don't know what the distinction between the two is, but I have seen that occasionally.
Well, Bruce, thanks a lot for calling. Comment, Mark.
It's a great comment from Bruce, simply because the mint family, when we consider the hardy mints, we need to be wary of the fact that they tend to spread. I do find now it's important to circle back and say most plectranthus that you would get at a garden center that are labeled as plectranthus and not mint per se. Again, they're being all in the same family. They have square stems. They're all vigorous. But most of the plectranthus are not hardy. They're tropicals for us, like the Swedish ivy Bruce mentioned and some of the others. But any mint family plant we need to be wary of, like bee balm, you know, Monarda. There's mountain mints, which have fragrant leaves and are great for pollinators. I do want to mention I planted 3 mints yesterday in the healing garden, and it was a banana mint, cotton candy mint, and pear mint, which sounds crazy, but they have these subtle fragrances when you rub the leaves. But what I did was I containerized them. I planted them in a 15-inch deep container and width, and the containers are being sunk in the garden with a lip. So the container is about an inch above grade, so 14 inches below grade, and that mint will be happy as a clam in that container, but I'm not going to let it send roots out and to spread or to jump over the side of the container. So I'm telling that mint where it can grow. And we have labels on it already, and people are coming out and they're like, oh my gosh, that mint does smell like cotton candy. So feel free to containerize your mints, sink them in the ground, but mint family should always be taken with a little bit of concern, particularly those hardy ones.
And Bruce, thanks again for your call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Rick in Colfax next. Hi, Rick.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Say, okay, so I have an abundance of cedar mulch, and I'm wondering if I, what your opinion would be to use that around blueberry bushes and also around, like, pea plants and vegetable plants in the garden. Is that doable or no?
Well, that's a great question. Is the mulch relatively fresh? Is that something that's been recently ground up?
Actually, yes, I believe so. I just bought it at the local landscape stuff, and it seems very fresh. It's got an excellent odor to it, so I'm assuming it's pretty fresh.
Yeah, yeah, and I actually don't mind. I like cedar mulches for their longevity, and ultimately the fact that it's a finer consistency, I think, is a good thing. The concern about blueberries, though, of course, is maintaining acidic soil. They really need a lower pH, so, and maybe you've achieved that, but you may want to consider a soil test, because you want to get the pH down between closer to 5 than anything else, like very acidic, and it takes a lot of work to do that. In terms of using fresh mulch of any sort, I'm only wary if it's very fresh and quite, you know, quite hot, because it is biodegrading, and the concern with mulch that might be right out of the shredder is that it is generating some heat and does utilize some nitrogen when it's breaking down. But I guess I'm wary of saying it's okay to use it right away, because I haven't seen it. But the concern about the blueberry bushes is more about the pH at this point. But mulching those types of plants makes sense to me for moisture retention and weed control. We may need to get another opinion on cedar as a fresh mulch, though.
Yeah. Okay, Rick, thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Pete in Milwaukee next. Hi, Pete.
Hi. I have a tart cherry tree and a Rainer cherry tree right next to each other, and I am forced to trim the branches because they hang over the garage. I'm having some work done. Is there anything that I need to put on the edge of the branches? You know, if they kind of like bleed out, but...
Yeah, you shouldn't have to do anything. So if you're pruning them, consider that structural pruning where you're taking branches all the way back to the trunk and get a good cut, you know, not a flush cut. You know, you want to leave a little bit there when you remove it and avoid, you know, proper pruning practices in short. But no, I wouldn't worry about doing anything with wound paint or anything like that. They should be just fine.
All right. There you go, Pete. Thanks so much. Appreciate the call. Let's see. Mike emailed to ask once again for the name of the rose bush you mentioned earlier, Mark.
Yeah. Let me try to remember this. So it's Blanc de Double Corbeil. So it's Blanc, then De, double, and then Corbeil is actually, it's Courbert. It's not even Corbet, it's Colbet or something like that. So Blanc de Double Colbet. And again, I'm not saying it correctly, but we have two patches of 5 each. So we have 10 of these roses in the healing garden, and they're currently blooming. They actually rebloom the whole season. There's some white blooms through the whole season, but that right now they are unbelievable in fragrance. And very few insect and disease problems, too.
So it's Blanc, B-L-A-N-C, D-E...
Mm-hmm.
Double.
Yep. Oh, you know, I'm sorry. It's Blanc Double de Corbeil. So not 2 DEs. So Blanc Double DE Colbert. And that's the fifth time I've not said it correctly, but use the Google and you'll be able to find it, folks.
There we go. Oh, boy. Marie in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Marie.
Well, hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about currants. About 15 years ago, I bought 2 currant bushes, and I have yet to get a currant on them. So last fall, I moved them to a what I call a sunnier spot, and still no luck.
So what do you call a sunnier spot, Marie?
Full sun. All day long, it gets sun.
Okay.
Yeah, it's tough to say. Do you recall the variety? Do you know what? Because there's a lot of different types of currants. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's tough to say because I'm trying to remember their mode of pollination and the fact that some fruiting shrubs benefit from having two different kinds or two different varieties. And I'm not saying that's the problem because moving them to, they definitely prefer full sun. The only other concern, do they seem to, is there any heavy deer browsing or do they die to the ground every season?
Nope. They're about waist high now, real leafy. They're very healthy looking. And that's exactly what I thought. Do they need another plant to pollinate?
I would toss that question to your local extension agent, and unless you have saved the tag, it'll be really hard to identify the variety, and likely species, because there are a couple different species as well. But my guess is if you were to include some different kinds in that vicinity, you probably would have more luck. And that's my theory, but I would follow up with an extension agent and see if you can narrow that down.
And Marie, plant seems to be doing really, really well. It might be, if you had some heavy nitrogen. I mean, if it's a really rich soil, Mark, would that make a difference?
Yeah, really rich soils, of course, you get a lot more stem and foliar growth, and sometimes that's at the expense of fruiting. And if you did see them bloom, the concern, again, is the pollination, achieving pollination. So a little more research, because the fact that they're vigorous, it sounds good, but there's something missing in the equation, obviously.
Yeah. Marie, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Ron in La Crosse up next. Ron, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, we had a no mow in May program that I registered for, so I didn't mow at all in May. The idea was let pollinators like bees and butterflies, come around, but I didn't get any flowers, and I was just wondering, I did have a lawn care service put down a fertilizer and a weed preventer, like crabgrass preventer, prior to that, letting the lawn grow. I just wonder, would that interfere with the pollinators?
Yeah, great question. And you bring up the No Mow May, which is starting to go nationwide, actually originated in Appleton three or four years ago. So, and you hit the nail on the head. The benefit of the program is having essentially weeds blooming within your lawn in May to provide nectar and pollen for early pollinator activity. So, yes, in all likelihood, that treatment eliminated the weeds. So what you likely had was a really lush turf that had no value for the pollinators. Having said that, my backyard is, I'm not ashamed to say, my backyard is creeping Charlie, violets, dandelions, and a little bit of turf, and we let it go as well. And we saw quite a bit of pollinator activity, of course, through May. I will say the real challenge, I would ask people to consider, the no mow is so well-intentioned, I understand that, but within the square footage of all our gardens, there's a lot of other plants we can include for early pollinators, early bulbs, early blooming perennials. So it's not just about our lawns. There's a lot more we can do for pollinators, but the no mow May thing is something to explore and do a little research on, but I'm digressing. It certainly was the lawn treatment that eliminated the weeds and that pollinator potential.
Thinking about my own lawn, because I did the same. I did the no mow May, and I had lots of. My lawn sounds like your lawn, Mark. And I had lots of vigorous growth. And fortunately, I was in Canada at the end of May, and my daughter Emily wound up having to mow it.
with a machete to start with, right?
She didn't complain, so I was happy to see to see it mowed back to 4 inches or so when I got home. That's for sure. Ron emailed to ask about ways to control bindweed without herbicide. He's been pulling it monthly during May through September. That limits it, but it is resilient.
Yeah, so that, and a heavy sigh there, because I've never won the battle with bindweed. And the real challenge with it is as you pull it, it literally snaps off at ground level or slightly below. There's these nodules on the lower stems and roots, actually. It's not too dissimilar to quack grass in that when you think you've got it, there's a portion of root that will regenerate. So I'm not aware of, you know, the elbow grease approach. If you keep pulling at it, and if you know bindweed, it twines around everything, and it's hard to extract and unwind and pull. We had some success when I was at Rotary Gardens, and I know the question was about not using herbicide, but we actually targeted with Q-tips some herbicide on the lowest of leaves. So we would actually trim the bindweed down and actually give it just a little nudge of herbicide in the hopes that it would track down through the root system. And using the Q-tips to not damage any surrounding plants, because that's bindweed's defense mechanism, is to just say, come and get me, you're going to have to hurt some of your good plants. So again, I don't have a good answer on manual control. I think it's impossible. I think it's a decade of just fighting it wherever it pops up.
Let's see. Polly emailed, the question about removing quackgrass brought to mind a delightful book by Colleen Johnston, and it's entitled All the World in a Blade of Quack. All the World in a Blade of Quack. And it follows her gardening adventures, focuses on not only the battle with quackgrass, but also the discovery of the joys and challenges of creating a garden.
Oh, that's fabulous, because we all have those battles, right, Larry?
That's for sure. I'm going to have to write that down, and so I remember. It might be fun to have Colleen on the show, or maybe it's a really old book. I don't know. We'll find out about it for sure. In the meantime, you can join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Mark, I expect you're constantly on the lookout for new and fun varieties of flowers to try out. Are there some brand new ones that, and you've mentioned a couple already, I guess, but are there some that deserve mention?
Well, you know, I think the general comment is, as consumers, it's exciting that there's such a wide variety of product available. And I, of course, always encourage folks to go to their local nurseries and garden centers. And the last 3 years, it's been slim pickings. I think, Larry, we've talked in the past that COVID, as horrible as it's been, has created a lot of renewed interest in gardening and a lot of new gardeners, and has made it a little competitive at our garden centers, which is okay. I'm really excited to see the continued development of more compact forms of some of our woody plants, some of our shrubs, and also perennials. And for example, when we think of the garden phlox as a fragrant perennial I mentioned earlier, there's still all the old-fashioned garden phlox that get 4 to 5 feet in the middle or back of a border, but now there's a breeding and development in these 15 to 18 inch, very short forms, still with fragrant flowers, but can be moved up to the front of the border. There's just no shortage of fun things to explore. And something we're doing here at the Healing Garden as well, and our exploration of scent, is getting into more of those tactilely induced plants we mentioned earlier. And that includes, I think we have 40 varieties of scented geraniums. Never planted really in our climate for their blooms, but to have people go by and see a label and rub a plant that smells like pine or orange, or there's actually one that's called Old Spice. It literally smells like Old Spice deodorant. It's unbelievable. So that engagement becomes important, but it's hard to pin down some of my current favorites, because a lot of them I'm evaluating, but the breeding continues, and do go out to your garden centers and nurseries. I've been shopping locally here, and there's still a nice selection, and chat with the folks there. And if you're interested in gardening for pollinators or have a specific theme like fragrance, they'll certainly help you out and guide you that way with appropriate plant materials.
You know, I was just thinking that may have been a difficult thing for you in your business of getting the flowers you needed and so forth for your clients.
it did become challenging. And, you know, I've always said there's a substitution for everything. And when I have a client that can't find a certain tree or a shrub, I think about the ornamental characteristics. You know, it's a it's a 5 foot tall shrub with maroon leaves. Well, we can't find this certain shrub, but maybe, you know, this one will work. And when you think, consider design, it's not always, it's certainly about a progression of bloom. We want to see flowers in our climate from late March and April into till hard frost, but consider that value of texture and form and winter interest. And but your comment, Larry, absolutely, it's been challenging to source product, because many of the nurseries further south of us get their orders earlier, yeah. And those order fulfillment is, I think, based on the squeakiest wheel. So, you just kind of nose around and see what everyone has. And I'm impressed mostly this year, to be honest. I'm very impressed with what's still at our nurseries. It's still a good selection.
A listener emailed that the caller that we had earlier with a non-blooming currant, the listener wondered if they may have gotten ornamental alpine currant by mistake.
That's interesting. That actually crossed my mind. An alpine currant is a very common landscape shrub. And if that caller is still on, you know, it's like if you're growing traditional currants, they're going to have thorny stems. And if you know, alpine currant has a smooth stem and a very glossy leaf. And so that's a great comment and worthy of investigation, because, you know, again, someone might go to the garden center and see alpine currant and think, oh, okay, I'm going to grow that, you know, for a fruiting source. And that's not what you would want. So,
and it's easy to tell.
It's very easy to tell the difference. Yeah.
Yeah, yep. For sure. Veronica emailed. She has tall hydrangeas that are planted by her sidewalk. She'd like to move them, but the roots are so dense, she's not sure how to dig them up. Any ideas?
You'd be surprised how well hydrangeas move, to be honest, and I wouldn't let the root system thwart your desire to do so. The real challenge, though, is the timing, because I certainly wouldn't do it in the heat of summer here. I would do a dormant move, either once it's dropped its leaves in October, and I'm speaking from a southern Wisconsin climate here, but once it's dropped its leaves in fall or in spring before it foliates, really get in there, give it a good move on a rainy day, water the heck out of it, and it should be fine. It'll regenerate roots very quickly. Just avoid the hot summer months, but they're tough as nails.
Mark Dwyer, our guest today, speaker, educator, author. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Questions about flowers or questions about your garden or perhaps the trees in your landscape, you can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mealer. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mealer here. Just a quick announcement. Members of Congress are holding hearings in their investigation into the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. The House Committee meets again on Monday. Join us for live NPR coverage starting at 9 o'clock in the morning on Monday. The committee has spent a year investigating what happened when the pro-Trump extremists stormed the Capitol, hoping to help overturn the 2020 election. Lawmakers are gathering evidence and hearing from witnesses. So join us for live NPR coverage Monday morning starting at 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio and also at WPR.org. Mark Dwyer, our guest today. Again, you can join in when open line gets you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Stephen Hayward. Steve, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, we have some type of bamboo growing up here in Hayward.
Okay.
And I was wondering if there is such a thing.
It's likely it's not a true bamboo, but you might be see something called Japanese knotweed. Does it die back to the ground every winter for you?
If I wasn't too
cut it down. I would imagine. No, it wouldn't. It would just stay standing as a bamboo, dried out bamboo stick.
Right. So it does regenerate new growth every year from ground level. You know, if it has jointed stems, if you're looking at it, and down in the southern portion of the state, we have this Japanese knotweed, which is quite hardy, that in one season here will get 8 to 10 feet tall, and it has this green jointed stem, ends up getting kind of a whitish flower, but it's a thicket. It continues to constantly send out growth, and I wonder if perhaps if you're able to send a photo to Larry, we could get an ID on it and give you a little more information. But true bamboo wouldn't make it up there, but there are some plants that are bamboo-like in appearance, and they're usually thugs, and we can try to narrow it down, I think, with a photo.
Yeah, they're invasive. They can be very invasive and sometimes difficult to control. I guess you need to know exactly what you're dealing with, though, don't you, Mark?
Absolutely. And we had a patch at Rotary Gardens that admittedly we had to use herbicide on, and it took 5 to 6 years of repeated applications, and a similar growth to some of the plants we've already talked about, in that the root system has a way to kind of wall off, you know, our attacks, and just continues to perpetuate itself. So it's a thug, no doubt.
How does it wind up, you know, suddenly it's there? How does it get there?
Yeah, it's tough to say, because I've seen it on roadsides here and there, and some people plant it. You know, they like the look of it, and it's not hard to dig up a chunk and move it. And my daughter's property in Janesville, you think about the four corners of a backyard's connecting, all with fences. Somebody in one of the corners planted it, and within 3 years it had come up in all four corners had it. And they had to come up with a collective plan to work together to get rid of it, because they knew what it was going to do, and that's, you know, take over. So now we're assuming that's the plant. But when I hear people say they have bamboo, I usually start leaning towards that Japanese knotweed.
Steve, thank you again. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Peter in Cottage Grove, on to you now. Hi, Peter.
Hey, how are you doing? Enjoy the show. Thank you so much for being there.
Sure.
I've got a question regarding, my wife came home from work. One of her colleagues had given her some mulberry sprouts, I think that from a tree or a bush. She's not sure. And I really don't know where I want to put them yet. And I was wondering if I read that I thought I heard that you could put them in large pots, like 24-inch pots. They're only about 11 inches high right now. Is that something that you can do? Can you put these in large pots?
Well, the short answer is yes, but I think we need to back up, and I'll mention it. It's likely it's white mulberry, and there's just a couple concerns, which is a hardy woody plant for us, but there are male and female. So if your interest is in the fruiting, if it's a male, you're not going to get the fruits. So you may be growing it to no avail, you know. Now, if it's a female, the challenge in a container is it still has to experience winter dormancy outside. So you'd have to, the concern is the soil in the container will crack the pot, or if we have a polar vortices, it might damage the plant because of the elevated roots. If it were planted in the ground as a typical tree, the concern with the female mulberries is twofold. Number one, they're messy. You know, in time as they fruit, they create a huge mess. And I grew up in a neighborhood, all the kids were eating from the local mulberry tree. We loved it, you know. But the birds will also spread it far and wide. And so I'm throwing a lot of negatives at you. But to your original question, you can grow it in a container, but you're not assured of the fruiting, and you're not assured of it perpetuating year after year based on how you treat that container in winter. And I hope that makes sense.
Yeah. And is it easy to tell if you've got a male or a female?
I don't know how to tell the difference. And we've had a mulberry in our backyard. We've been nurturing for about 8 years, and we've realized it's a male. So he's got to go, unfortunately. But I'm not going to miss the mess, because it's near our patio, and we don't really want that sort of a mess. So they're delicious, and I remember the flavor, and I love mulberries, but they're messy, and the birds like them too, so keep that in mind.
Thanks, Peter. Appreciate it. Dean in Green Lake, your turn. Hi, Dean.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I have an old lilac bush. It's probably 9 or 10 feet tall. Some of the stems are 2 inches across, and it doesn't flower a lot. And I was wondering, what time of year can I cut it back, and how much should I cut it back?
Well, this it's a great question, because lilacs with age do get they tend to need some rejuvenation, and there's a lot of literature and research done on lilac rejuvenation. And really, your best approach is I would wait until the dormant season and remove to the ground the largest canes. And by doing so, and so you get in there and you pick your largest stems, and you sometimes it's hard to get in there and do that. But by removing the larger canes, energy is redirected to the younger growth, which is a lot better at flowering and will fill in very quickly. And, you know, granted, you're going to lose any potential flowers from what you remove. But by doing that rejuvenation, which is typical of the larger French lilacs, that's a common approach. Works very well, but you never want to remove more than a third of the canes. You know, so it may be something you do over a couple of years, because I haven't seen the actual lilac, but just by removing some of those larger stems, I think you'll see a better plant over the coming years.
And if you just and I think you're right, you can do this over a period of time, but I'd take out the biggest ones, maybe if there's 30 stems, take out 10, would you?
I would, absolutely. I tend to brutalize lilacs, and they don't mind it. They're encouraged to, you know, they want to bloom and be pollinated and reproduce and all that. So they're pretty tough woody shrubs.
You're going to be happy with the result, I think, Dean. Thank you very much for calling. Pam and Kellogg, your turn. Hi.
Good morning. I have two problems, and they've both gotten away from me. I have rugosa roses, and I have a trumpet vine, and they are both just popping up everywhere. I don't like to use any Roundup or anything, but I don't know how to. I mean, they're just really going crazy.
Yeah, the real challenge is those are two plants that it's likely your rugosa roses and the trumpet vine are suckering. And trumpet vine is notorious for that, where you'll see what looks like a baby trumpet vine 10 to 15 feet away, and what it really is a root sprout. So the danger, of course, in spraying that or your rugosa rose is likely suckering as well. They do thicket. So what you need to do is manual control. The danger, and I feel the rose can be managed. I think you can manage that with whether you get some help or do it yourself, just getting in there and pulling up some of those runners and cutting them back and trying to condense the plant back to its original silhouette that you like. The trumpet vine's a different beast, because the manual control just encourages it. And I haven't recommended a trumpet vine to anyone for 20 years because of that. As beautiful as it is, it's a very vigorous woody vine, as you know. But once you start getting into the root suckering, and this happens with trumpet vine, trumpet honeysuckle, wisteria to a certain degree, it becomes a huge monumental challenge. So there's not a really easy way to keep that in check for any degree of time or permanently. It's going to keep doing that to you. So I don't have a good answer besides removing it and trying to eradicate, you know, those suckers, because it's going to keep doing that.
Yeah, unfortunately. Gene in Madison, your turn. Hi, Gene.
Hi. My problem is thistles. I have thistles growing in my lily bed. It's tiger lilies and day lilies, and they're just, I have tried to dig them out spring and fall, pulling out all the roots I can, but they just come back even worse. I wonder if there's any idea of how to control them.
Well, thistles are certainly problematic, and it's likely there's two things happening with the recurrence of the thistles. You know, the root is literally like a white carrot. I mean, I like to pick a rainy day and with gloves, of course, try to pull them straight up. And usually you get a good pop and they come up, and then you're looking at a 15-inch white root, not realizing it was a 16-inch root, and that little 1-inch piece down there is going to regenerate. So it's typically difficult to get the entire root, and sometimes the roots will branch, so little pieces will regenerate. It's also likely at some point there was seed set, or when thistle reseeds, the seed is viable for a certain amount of time. So when I felt like I've cleared a thistle patch, I realize I haven't, and I'm just going to have to keep dealing with repeat offenders. And I don't worry where they originated. I just keep going at them. So manual control over time is possible. The other thing is a little dab of herbicide will at least track down and kill the primary plant, but you still have seedlings likely to deal with. And the danger, of course, with your them being amongst your lilies is you don't want to damage your good plant. So just keep at it. You can win that battle.
You can win it, Gene. Thank you very much for calling. Mark Dwyer, our guest today. Speaker, educator, author, his business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. And I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we visit with Mark Dwyer, a speaker, educator, and author, has degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry, and his business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. So what gardening questions do you have? Join in. Give a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Chris in Dousman is up next. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Larry. I have a problem with sumac in my yard, and it started last summer. And in the fall, we cut it back and sprayed it with Roundup, and it just is coming in. And when I'm able to grab the roots and pull it, it's frightening how far the roots go. And I'm afraid my whole yard is going to be filled with sumac. Is there any way I can control it or get rid of it for good?
Yeah, that's it's a great question because as with some of the plants we talked about earlier, the problem is the vigor of those roots that can regenerate very quickly and send up those root sprouts. So a lot of times the encouragement they need is that initial removal. And aside from consistent manual control and perhaps more herbicides, there's not an easy way to deal with it. Now, if it's continually coming up in a lawn that you mow, what I've seen with some suckering plants is that perpetual mowing, constantly mowing, will eliminate the vigor, and you eventually can win that battle by just having it constantly mown. But if it's coming up in adjacent areas or garden beds, you've run into the ropey roots and trying to pull it up and how connected it is. You just have to keep doing that and perhaps, again, some sporadic spray because a lot of that is connected and an herbicide should track through a good portion of the root system. But that's going to be a long battle, without a doubt.
Thank you, Chris. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Aaron in Lake Mills, we turn to you next. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Hi, Larry. So I have a toca plum tree that we just put in this spring. It's about 5 or 6 feet tall, and it's got a nice vase shape. My problem is that only kind of the outer branches are having leaves and flowered, and kind of the inner trunk and inner branches don't seem to be doing much. So I'm wondering if I need to cut those back or if I should just wait and see.
Yeah, well, I guess what I would do is wait and see. But if you can, you know, reach into those inner branches and give them a little scratch, you know, and see if there's still some green in the cambium to see if they're still alive. If they're brittle and they snap, you know, obviously you could remove those. So if they're still pliable with that green, let them go because, you know, the stunted growth is not unusual with some woody trees. The hope is that'll come back. And I think it's a little too early to remove those unless they are brittle. And if they do have to be removed, by the way, you'll find that the outer branches will start to repopulate the inside with, you know, there'll be available light in there, and they'll send some side branches in, and it should fill itself out. So all is not lost, but give a closer look on those inner branches.
There you go, Aaron. Thank you for calling. You can join in to 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. George emailed. He'd like to add a small pond, possibly with a waterfall, to his back garden, and wonders what advice you have before he starts. Also, are there good resources, and what are some good plants to add around the pond?
Well, a lot of great questions. I think, first and foremost, any water feature that folks add, whether it's a small fountain or a pond or in waterfalls, I always ask them to really consider the maintenance, because we're jumping ahead here, assuming this exists. And, you know, there's winterization, there's, you know, if there's fish involved, the cleanup, pumps, circulators. I don't know what size he's interested in. So, you know, volume of water becomes in depth, of course, is a factor. So considering the types of ponds, you know, before you start digging a hole, talk to your local pond experts. There's a lot of landscapers that do great jobs with water features, and some that specialize in that. Really talk it through to see what you're interested in and that you can absorb that maintenance, because the selection of a liner and, you know, I could go on and on. We could have a full show, of course, about these water features. But there's a lot of exciting plants you can put along the edges. And, for example, this healing garden in which I work, we've put a lot of native plants along the edge for the combination of some erosion control, certainly beautification, but also pollinator habitat. You know, we've got some swamp milkweeds. We've got some native irises, some fun things. The real problem we've run into is cattails have inundated the pond. And as much as I like the beauty of cattails, they're a thug in an enclosed pond system. So you need to be wary of the challenges that are inherent with any water feature. And now that I've been Debbie Downer about it, do talk to folks that have installed them and get some more perspective on what they can provide based on what you envision.
I was trying to remember don't think there are any pond publications in UW Extension. I think the DNR, though, may, if the DNR website may have something as well about ponds.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly worth looking at anyway. Mary in Milwaukee emailed, in her yard that's on the edge of a woods, a box elder tree sprouted and grew about 3 feet high in just moments almost. She'd like to get rid of it and wonders what suggestions. So it grew to about 3 feet high, so it's not very high to begin with.
Yeah, you know, box elder, I think most folks know it's a type of maple. It is a native tree, but it can, it's not very long-lived. So in terms of desirable maples, it doesn't fall into that category at all. So I would agree that removal is the way to go. But at only 3 feet tall, you should be able to dig that out and get a good portion of that root system and just pop it out of there. And they root deeply, so it's not necessarily going to be easy even at that size. But, you know, tag team with a group and get it out of there, because, you know, again, it's one that will likely recede once it gets to reproduction age as well.
Yeah. John in Janesville, we'll go to you now. Hi, John.
Hi. I'm in my car, so can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we're fine.
Okay, so anyway, I know as I talked to the person that took my call, you've already talked about Canada thistle, but I have a fair amount or some spots in my prairie planting. I have an acre prairie planting around my house, and I just want your spin on managing and controlling, because anyone I've talked to, and I've been dealing with it for the last 3 or 4 years, it's been very you know, very resistant and all that kind of stuff. But I'm just curious what your guests thought in sure. Picking his brain on how to manage it or control it or eliminate or whatever.
Okay.
That's all.
Yeah, great question, John. And, you know, and I was at Rotary Gardens in Janesville for many years, and if you drive by on Palmer Drive there, you'll see the prairie restoration. And Canada thistle is an absolute thug. And one third of that prairie about 15 years ago was entirely Canada thistle. It out-competed everything else. There was nothing but thistle. And we ended up having to rely on an herbicide application, and not just once. We had to spray it, and, you know, I sound like I'm a spray-happy guy, and I'm really not, but that's a plant that necessitated that. But to our early comments on thistle, it had set so much seed over the years, we waited till the following spring for another batch to come up. And then that prairie has been maintained also by frequent burns. So we then integrated desirable plants after 2 years of fighting that thistle corner. It's now become a decent portion of that prairie, although every now and then we run into, a thistle would pop up. So if it's sporadic, you know, I think spot treatment of herbicides is the way to go every time you see it. And because for a one-acre prairie that you have, it's not – you know, manual control, I think, is out of the picture. But don't let it get a foothold and never let it bloom. And so you just have to be super aggressive with it, which I think you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, John. Good luck. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Bill in Oregon emailed that rain is the key to successful vine removal. When the soil is saturated, you have your best shot at getting all of it. He starts from the end, traces the vine back, and gently pulls the roots at all contact points. And he pursues breaks with a small spade. He said he's cleared large areas of poison ivy, wild grapes, and other undesirable vines using that method. What do you think?
That's a great advice. And, you know, I think when we talk about, you know, wait till it rains to go after your thistles and, you know, wait till it rains to get at certain weeds, that makes a lot of sense to me. And it sounds like that manual battle with wet soil and really being patient with tracking those roots has worked well for this gentleman. And the elbow grease involved is certainly worth it because, you know, you think about these root suckers constantly coming up. I think a lot of people give up and, you know, that's it's probably why kudzu is in, you know, enveloped the entire, you know, Southeast United States. So it's
terrible. That's terrible stuff.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Yeah, but good advice for sure.
Dave emailed, he has a bed of Japanese iris and the radial growth is now against the structural containment. The middle portion is non-existent. Can he take a piece of the outer edges and replant in the middle of the dead portion, removed and amended with soil?
Absolutely, and I'm glad, and he hit the nail on the head with amended with soil, because you think about any perennial, the original planting, the most vigorous growth on a perennial, irises included, is on the outer portion. So that vigorous growth, as it expands, creates a donut, and the original location of the plant is vacated, and that soil is certainly leaner. And by amending it and poking in some divisions, absolutely, you can do that. You can do that with any perennial, but in this situation, yes.
Courtney in Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. So my husband and I moved into a house about 2 years ago, and we inherited a front and a backyard that seemed to be overgrown native plant garden. And we kind of figured out the backyard, but the front yard, it looks like a bed of weeds at this point. And we just don't know how to start over with that. Do we have to use herbicide? Do we mow it down? How do we start over?
Okay.
It's a great question, because I can understand your concern, and you're thinking if they're really good plants, I don't want to necessarily remove them, but I don't know what they are at this point. And there's a danger in letting them bloom so you can identify them, because then they may start to go to seed and be problematic. I think that the blunt question or comment for you is if you don't desire that style in the front, maybe that eradication is the way to go and starting fresh. The challenge with wildflower gardens that maybe have been untended, because you might have inherited something that, you know, looks kind of meadowish, naturalist approach, but it has a lot of weeds that you can't identify, taking photographs, sharing them with people at nurseries and trying to find out what some of these things are may be helpful. But when you get a matrix, this combination of both good and bad, which is very likely, many times starting over is really the way to go. So that, I'm being very ambiguous because I don't want to tell you what to do specifically. But again, I think you've inherited what will be a headache in trying to figure out what's both good and bad. But it can be done.
I started over in mine, Courtney, and now I have a pretty nice, you know, I first moved into the home that we have now. I did not like the front yard at all, and I just restarted, and now I've got great plants growing, and it's I don't mow anything because they're all flowers. So there you go. Thank you for calling. Anita in Lindenhurst, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Anita.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of run this past you because we feed birds. We have big bird feeders and everything. And I'm kind of picky when I'm looking at the ingredients in the bird seeds. And then I noticed that more and more recently, almost all of them have niter seed in them. And then I was told that that is actually thistle, which, of course, we just covered that a few minutes ago. But, you know, then I learned that it's not related to it. So, and I have to tell you, the reason I thought it was thistle is because I was standing in Menards with the bag in my hand, and I called the company's 800 number, and they told me that's thistle. So all this time, I'd go through all the bird seed, and I try to get one that doesn't have thistle, because who wants to plant that in their yard? Well, so now I'm like, well, what do you think about that, about the Niger?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on bird seed. Maybe Larry is, but I know the Niger seed is a lot of birds love it, and particularly in winter feeders. I don't know that it becomes problematic in the garden, and I wouldn't have been able to say it's a type of thistle, to be honest. I don't even really know its background. I will say this, though. Maybe folks have noticed when you use sunflower seeds, where they're dropping around a feeder, you won't see plants growing. And sunflower seeds have a chemical in them that inhibits plant growth. So it's and that's neither good nor bad, but I always encourage people with a feeder to dedicate some open space, know that you're going to have open space underneath it if you're using sunflower seeds, which is just sort of inevitable. But I'm sorry, I can't answer the Niger seed question. I don't know.
I do have Niger seed in one of my feeders, and I can say that over the years, I haven't had any problem with the thistle, the Niger spreading away from the feeder, or mm-hmm. even growing in the, you know, it just gets outcompeted by the perennials that I've got
right.
there.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't worry much about it, Anita, but thank you for calling. Margie emailed that she would like to move a large bleeding heart plant from her mom's house in northern Wisconsin to her home in Dane County. Will it mm-hmm. tolerate that? And if so, when should she do it?
Yeah, great question. And absolutely, it would tolerate it. So the challenge is you have to do it when the plant is dormant. And, you know, bleeding hearts are just finishing blooming. They'll start to go dormant. I'm assuming it's kind of an old-fashioned, one of the larger types. But what I would do is wait until late August, September. And so all it will be by then is likely withered stems or yellowish, floppy stems. At that point in time, it's heading into dormancy. And dig it up. It's going to have a woody mass of root system and crown. It's not an easy dig. So you're going to want to get a lot of soil around it and put it in a big pot and move as much of that base as you can. And get it home, plunk it in, don't worry about it. It'll be up next spring. Plant it at the same level that you dig it and let it settle in your home yard, and it won't even know it was moved. It'll be fine.
Mary in North Lake, we go to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I have lost a couple of nine barks. I had three of them. I only have one left. I don't know. It's looking kind of bare, so I wonder if there's any way I can save it or it's a lost cause.
Yeah, the nine barks, it's interesting you mentioned that because 10 years ago, nine barks were ironclad. You know, I've used them in designs. I would say they're going to be great. All different colors, as you know, different heights, native species. But more recently, the last 5 or 6 years, they've been getting a lot of mildew issues, losing leaves, getting dead stems. So that's a long answer. The short answer is what I would recommend, and you could even do it still now, which seems crazy, but cut it back severely. Something I do with nine barks every winter is cut them back to 3 or 4 inches. I lose the flowers on those, but what I get is brand new vigorous growth. And the small ones, they poof up to roughly their mature size, with the exception of the largest ones. But by getting fresh growth, I feel like I get a brand new plant every year. So if you have a struggling nine bark, and I had a client recently with something very similar, cut it way back and let it bounce back. And I think you'll see a renewed plant. If not, something else is going on, and I would, you know, move on to something different. But it's going to be interesting to observe what these challenges are for nine bark, which again was just one of the go-to plants for so many years. So
yeah.
It won't mind the abuse. So beat it up a little and hope for the best.
Thanks, Mary. Appreciate it. Cameron emailed. He's looking for suggestions for some deciduous trees. It's going to be in an open yard with no cover, and he wants something that will grow pretty large. Doesn't say where he's located, but
yeah. Well, you know, it's you know, they always say you don't plant a tree for yourself, you plant it for your grandchildren. So, you know, I'm a huge fan, assuming it's open space and decent soils. I certainly love maples. I'm a huge fan of sugar maple, our state tree in Wisconsin. Not necessarily the fastest growing tree, but I'm starting to lean away from trees that are favored by Japanese beetles, which tend to be some of the lindens. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of honey locusts because they tend to break up and be brittle. But, you know, the question being about desirable trees, there are some great oaks as well. And folks have understandably been concerned about oak wilt, particularly on the red and black oak family, those with the pointed lobes. But I love swamp white oak. I love white oak. Those with the rounded lobes are a lot safer from oak wilt problems and are just very amazing stately trees, as are bur oaks. Not necessarily easy to transplant, but go to your local nursery, those that sell trees, and nose around a little and see what they have. And in terms of larger shade trees that'll get 50 feet plus, both in height and width, there's a lot that will do well in our Midwest climates. The questions are about your soils, available space, and your patience, you know, how the growth rate on these things. But there's a lot of good plants out there.
And on that note, I want to thank you, Mark, so much for being with us today. It's always a pleasure, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you again.
Thank you, Larry. Have a good one.
Mark Dwyer, our guest today, his business is titled Landscape Prescriptions by MD. And he'll be back and we'll talk with him again. Always fun to visit with him. Just looking ahead to Monday at this time, tech expert Beth DeAngelo will be back to talk about streaming services and take your other IT questions as well. That's Monday starting at 11 on the show. In the meantime, thanks a lot for listening. I hope you have a great weekend, but keep listening. What's in store? I'm Larry Mueller.